Special phone numbers. From the East and Midwest, call collect at area code 212-749-3311. From the West at 212-749-3357. And from the New York area at 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Calls host, Del Shields.
Good evening. Chronic hunger and malnutrition exist in this country, affecting some 10 to 14.5 million of our fellow Americans, and increasing in severity and extent from year to year. How this is possible in a land of affluence and agricultural plenty? It cannot help but aggravate a sense of injustice, of grievance, of frustration and revolt. Famine in India triggers relief shipments from the United States. Hunger in Biafra evokes compassion and a desire to help. But hunger in America makes only a fleeting ripple in our national conscience. It is almost impossible to conceive that only 18% of the food programs reach the poor, that numbers of newborn who survive through the first month die between the second month and their second birthday of malnutrition, that protein deprivation between the ages of 6 months and a year causes permanent brain damage to many young infants, that nutritional anemia exists in from 30 to 70% of children from poverty backgrounds. Hunger that is all the more cruel because it seems so unnecessary. Standing by in Washington, D.C. is Robert Choate, formerly with the Citizens Board of Inquiry into Hunger and Malnutrition in the United States, and also a member of the National Institute of Public Affairs. Mr. Choate, good evening, sir.
Good evening, Del. Nice to be with you.
And thank you so very much for being with us. Mr. Choate, how is it possible that there is hunger and malnutrition in this country? Don't we have enough programs to meet these conditions?
In the United States, the problems of getting food to people in the right amounts seems not to be a farm question, but an economic, political, or racial decision which must be overcome or surmounted so that each person in each county, no matter what their status in life, gets enough food. It is not, obviously, a lack of available food. We have plenty of that.
Well, since it's obvious we have enough food, is the problem mainly the private food industry, or is it the bureaucracy of the federal and state governments?
Well, if one looks at it philosophically, the private enterprise system rewards business with profits. Therefore, those that the food industry sells to must give them a profit. But unfortunately, in the United States, there are some people who cannot buy enough food in sufficient quantities to give private enterprise a profit, so private enterprise doesn't pay much attention to them. This is almost built into a free enterprise system. All right, that means then that government has an obligation to either extend private enterprise in the food line out to those who can't afford food on their own, or government has got to run a substitute sort of grocery delivery system instead of private enterprise. I think what we are seeing now is private enterprise doing a fairly good job in getting lots of food out on lots of shelves at somewhat reasonable price so that the average American can eat well if he buys judiciously, but the impoverished American just can't afford to buy all the things down the grocery shelf that he should have to have a balanced diet. As a result, he doesn't buy either enough food or buy enough varieties of food to give him the type of diet that he needs. Therefore, government somehow must move in and make the federal programs work where they're not working now, or make them work in better abundance than they're working now, so that even those without much money can get enough cash into their pocket to increase their food budget, or enough food from a federal warehouse so that their families aren't chronically hungry.
A popular concept in the country is that the government pays farmers sometimes to produce food and at other times not to produce food, that annually millions of dollars in wheat go up in flames, and that we conduct other methods of dispensing with food that does not go directly to people. Now, how is it possible that we could have such a program and still allow 10 million Americans to starve to death annually?
If you get into the hunger issue deeply, you have to recognize that there is some merit to a farm produce control apparatus to keep the price of food out of extreme heights and extreme depths. In other words, I do believe that there's got to be some sort of a federal agricultural policy. I think you'll find every nation in the world, every civilized nation in the world, has some sort of government control over farm production. And I think that works to the benefit of even the poorest man. But our propensity for paying attention to bigger and bigger profits, bigger and bigger farms, bigger and better pesticides and things like that has led us to concentrate at the federal level on those who produce the food and has allowed us to push into a second-class category those who are hungry after these farm programs have been implemented. Actually, the people who are hungry today in America have really absolutely nothing to do with agricultural policy. Perhaps I would condition that statement by saying there are a number who used to be in farm labor who today are unemployed because certain farms have been put out of work. But in general, the guy who is hungry today in the United States is totally divorced from any sort of agricultural policy. It is a great mistake to have the federal food programs operated by the Department of Agriculture, who must inevitably pay more attention to the big farmers of this country. One would hope that this incoming administration could redesign the administration of federal food programs so that they could be operated with concern for the consumer, for the hungry person, and perhaps with less concern for the farmers whose surplus the commodity program and the school lunch program is supposed to eat up.
When we speak of hunger in America, are we saying that there are people who actually are starving without food, or are we discussing that there are people who do not have enough to eat, or people who do not have the right kinds of food to eat?
Well, I would like to start out this evening's conversation by stressing certain points. I don't think it's correct to say that 10 million Americans are starving to death or are starving each day. I think what we ought to say is that there are apparently somewhat near 10 million people in America who have serious food problems brought about by their poverty circumstances. Such people may be underfed or they may be badly fed. This brings us to two human conditions. Either they are undernourished or they are malnourished.
Well, am I right then in assuming that you're saying that there are no Americans starving to death today?
To the contrary, I do think that there are people dying from a shortage or lack of food. The majority of these would be infants in their first couple of years, or the aged, who are rapidly weakening because they hadn't been given enough food. But starving, to me, is a gradual term in which the body is described as slowly going downhill or rapidly going downhill from lack of food. Those people who are alive today in the United States obviously eat something. They may not eat the right things. They may eat less calories than they should and hence are slowly withering away. Infants may be on sub-diets or sub-formulas where they aren't getting enough nutrients out of the bottle. But the majority of people who would be dying from a shortage of food today in the United States, I would put in the infant category or the aged category. Now, there are millions, in addition to that, who are in depleted health condition, who are not vigorous, dynamic, alert, who are not able to compete in a free enterprise society the way the rest of us are because of a debilitated body condition brought about by underfeeding or malfeeding.
Well, how do you compare the starving that is taking place in America and the starving that is taking place in Biafra and the starving that's taking place in India?
Well,
is it a question of semantics? Or are we not discussing
not really.
People who...
No, I think you've got starvation and famine. These are very big words indicating a severe, gross condition in which people are literally dying in the streets. It happens by the hundreds or by the thousands. In the United States, I don't think you're going to see either tens or hundreds of people dropping in the streets from bad eating practices brought about by their poverty. You are going to see people who gradually are weakened, who go to an early grave because they can't stay healthy enough the way the rest of us can by eating adequate amounts of food. But the Biafran situation of today is unique for today because even in India, not so many people today are starving from lack of food. Famine has appeared in cycles in past years over the many last centuries, and it does seem to operate in cycles. We don't have that sort of a condition here in the United States. What we have is undernutrition and malnutrition brought about by political, racial, and economic disattention.
Our conversation tonight is Hunger USA. 10 million Americans are starving to death right now, even though Mr. Schott will not go along with our premise. And our guest tonight is Mr. Robert Schott of the National Institute of Public Affairs. And we'd like to remind our Night Call listeners that Night Call is your program, and we always want to hear from you. So reminding to you once again of our telephone numbers here in New York. It's 866-5010. That's if you're calling in locally from New York, 866-5010. If you're calling in from the East or the Midwest, it's area code 212-749-3311. That's area code 212-749-3311. If you're calling in from the West Coast, it's area code 212-749-3357. That's area code 212-749-3357. Remember, we welcome your calls, Collect. So let's take our first call tonight from Detroit, Michigan. Mr. Wilson is hearing Night Call over WJLB. Mr. Wilson?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening. I'd like to ask Mr. Schott, first I have a statement. I'm a college student here in Detroit, and I personally feel that student unrest and racial unrest in the country is partly due because a great percentage of college students are concerned about these things. Hunger and racial unrest, but you mentioned that mass hunger in the United States is due to political, racial, and economic reasons. I was wondering if a mass program was inaugurated to alleviate these conditions. Wouldn't it tend to create a cycle where these people who were fed through mass food programs would still be second-class citizens? Under the same terms, economic terms, racial and political terms?
I think that, in a sense, you're right. If we lick the problems on the hunger scene, there's still the educational scene, the health scene, the housing scene, the employment scene, the transportation scene. So we're talking about a small piece of the problems faced by people in an affluent society who just plain don't have enough money to enter into the swim of things. The college students of today who are highly upset with the direction that the country is taking perhaps sense better than many older people that there is an awful lot of hypocrisy in our society.
I agree.
Any country that pays farmers not to grow food, that ships food overseas in a giveaway program, and at the same time has large numbers of poor people at less than full health because they can't get enough to eat for their family day in, day out, around the year, this society must be considered quite hypocritical.
Yes, and Mr. Schultz, one more short question, please. If this would tend to create a vicious circle by alleviating the hunger, yet continuing the circle with keeping these people who need this help second-class citizens or lesser than affluent Americans, then what do you see as a possible means of alleviating this tendency?
Well, I'm a little confused by your cycle. I think that one has to look at the problems of the less successful in a competitive society in sort of a comprehensive way. In other words, our whole society is sort of looking up the economic ladder, if I can merge two expressions. And as we look up the economic ladder and try to figure out how to climb those rungs ourselves, we quite often forget that usually we're displacing somebody, that somebody else may be moving down, or that somebody may have never gotten on the first rung of the ladder by themselves. And it is the latter group, those who are really in a disadvantaged condition in our economic society, who may prove to be our Achilles heel. I think you will find the less competitive, the less successful in a communist society, in a socialist society, in the free enterprise society, you'll find it everywhere. But I think that the nation, in fact the whole world, will be watching how we handle such problems as a shortage of food amongst some of our people to see whether we really have any sincerity in our statements that the free enterprise system is the best system for everybody around the world. Beyond that, I can't really say that it's going to be cyclical, that some other problem will crop up. I think we've got to devote our attentions to those who are still on the first rung of the economic ladder, and we've got to figure out a means of either how we can get them into the total society in a competitive role, or provide them with a minimum standard of living below which we Americans won't be embarrassed to see them living.
Mr. Wilson, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. Our conversation tonight, Hunger USA. Our guest, Mr. Robert Schott of the National Institute of Public Affairs, calling in from Washington, D.C. We'll return to our guest following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest hunger expert Robert Schott after station identification. Black is a red-blooded American color. The black showed the color of his blood in places like Vietnam and Korea and every other all-American battleground since the Revolution. Every time his country calls for help, he hears. But we don't seem to hear him call. If black and white would listen with their hearts, they could hear each other. That's what Night Call is all about. It lets people air their views, man to man, color to color, live from phones anywhere in the country. A syringe full of junk bites into black and white skin with the same ruining surge. And a black mother cries over her child just like a white one does. The problems are the same. The characters just have different colors. Night Call's person-to-person nationwide radio hookup lets the black and white tell it like it is. Night Call, each weeknight on this station. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to Robert Schott about Hunger USA. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And tonight our conversation, Hunger USA, 10 million Americans are starving right now, and our guest calling in from Washington, D.C. is a hunger expert, is Mr. Robert Schott of the National Institute of Public Affairs. We'll take a local call this time. Mr. Steele is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Mr. Steele? Mr. Steele? All right, Mr. Steele is not with us. This time out to Kansas City. Mr. Stevenson is hearing Night Call over KPRS-FM. Mr. Stevenson?
I'd like to ask you, first off, I'll start off, I'm a student of Central High, you know, and I'd like to ask you, do you agree or do you think that the United States should, you know, send food or like the CARE volunteers, you know, or food, you know, overseas when it's people here in the United States who, need, you know, could use that money over here?
Well, I would have to answer you, Mrs. Stevenson, that I do think that we can afford to feed both our total population here and some in foreign countries who temporarily, we trust, do not have adequate food supplies of their own. We do have the agricultural production means in this country to take care of all of our own people and to take care of some nations when they face a sudden crop failure due to drought or something like that. I do wish that we would take care of our own first.
Okay.
And I do wish that we would recognize that while we're doing a fair job in feeding 95% of our people, that last 5% is really the proof of the pudding as to whether we have not only the agricultural system here in this country, but we also have the marketing and delivery systems so that everybody gets adequate food.
Okay, then. Thank you.
Thank you for calling, sir. This is Night Call in New York. Hunger USA is our conversation tonight with Mr. Robert Schott, calling in from Washington, D.C. This time up to Syracuse, New York. Mr. Kravitz is hearing Night Call over WAER-FM. Mr. Kravitz?
Good evening, sir.
Good evening, sir.
My question for Mr. Schott is simply this. I was wondering what we, as interested and potentially active Americans, can do to remedy the severe problem which we're facing here at home.
First and foremost, both Vice President Humphrey and President-elect Nixon have spoken out in the last 60 days rather forcefully about how they would like to correct the present inadequacies of federal food programs. We both know that it is quite often true that a politician makes a statement in the heat of a campaign and somehow seems to forget it after he gets in office. I would hope that as many listeners as possible write to President-elect Richard Nixon, care of the White House. He has an office adjoining the White House that opened up the other day. And write to President-elect Richard Nixon and ask that he pay attention to the problem of hunger within the United States. That probably will do as much good as anything.
But, sir, I was wondering, since there seems to be a bit of bungling among the federal bureaucracy, might it not be better if private interests were more involved?
I would guess that to get food out in the proper proportions, in the proper condition, to the 5% of America that we're here talking about, 10 million Americans, that it will have to be a joint government industry effort. There's no doubt about it that private food industry has perfected an amazingly complicated but efficient method of getting food supplies out to most Americans. It is also true that the government, no matter how well it tries to perform in the grocer line, cannot match the efficiency of the ordinary supermarket. So I think what we've got to do is to figure out some various techniques, some having a preponderance of governmental effort and some having a preponderance of private industry effort, which when combined one with the other, finally get enough food out to the 5% of Americans who are underfed or badly fed today.
Would you seem to be endorsing the type of federal supermarket in a local area?
Not necessarily. I think that, for instance, in the case of Indians on Arizona Indian reservations, there is a role where the government has largely failed in getting adequate supplies of food to Indians in the proper amounts, in the proper condition. there, I think the federal effort either has to be drastically revised or private industry has got to try to accomplish the same role under some sort of a contract basis and replace the insipid governmental effort. On the other hand, if one is talking about a county in South Carolina where 90% of the people, including a good share of the poor, do have adequate access to food, I think what we've got to do is increase the buying power of the poor in that county so that they can choose their own foods to prepare as they wish. And we, in effect, have got to devise an income supplement system or a food stamp system that really means to help the poor. Today's food stamp program is a farce. It is a ridiculous effort, which I think is primarily oriented towards subsidizing the grocer and not towards helping the poor person.
In addition, though, to the food stamp program, might it not also be advisable to institute some sort of educational procedure in the proper types of nutrition which a family would need?
Well, if we look at the long run, obviously increasing the buying power of the poor and increasing the education of the poor so that they can protect that buying power, those are the best long-range goals. But that might take 5 or 10 years, and a lot of our Americans are going to be hungry tonight and hungry tomorrow morning. And I think we can move ahead quite quickly in the development of joint government industry efforts to get food out in proper amounts where it's not getting to now.
Mr. Kravitz, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. Hunger USA is our discussion or our conversation tonight with Mr. Robert Schott, calling in from Washington, D.C. Mr. Schott, we stated, or rather you stated earlier in the program, that there is food available in America. But I was curious, when we talk about starvation, and we know that there are certain families throughout America whose diets are made up of beans and rice and margarine and lard, and where they receive perhaps one can of meat per person per family per month, aren't these people on the periphery of starvation?
No, I don't think they are in as much danger of starvation as those that can't get onto the commodity or food stamp program. Dell, let's take a look at these figures. There are roughly 27 million poor. There are only 6 million of those poor who are permitted onto federal food programs. So there are 21 million impoverished Americans who get no benefit out of either the commodity program or the food stamp program. So that I would say those in the most dire straits are those who can't get any help because of some local political jurisdiction or because the Congress will not recognize that these people also are hungry. Another point to think about is that in many places, the local school lunch program is providing some of the poor with their only square meal of the day. But what happens to those who are not on school lunches during the summer recess? What happens to the 4 million poor who are not permitted to have free school lunches and can't afford to buy them at the going rate?
Mr. Schott, would you be kind enough to hold your point?
Yeah.
We'll be returning right after station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest hunger expert Robert Schott after station identification. Next week on Night Call, a new left American revolutionary, a crime psychiatrist, a spokesman for the homosexuals of America, the black co-star of Mission Impossible, and a black television correspondent. Monday, co-founder Tom Hayden of the Students for a Democratic Society. Tuesday, Dr. James Brussell, the crime psychiatrist who helped solve the mysteries of the Mad Bomber, the Wiley murders, the Boston Strangler, and the Coppolino case. Wednesday, a mystery member of the Mattachine Society, an organization of American homosexuals. Thursday, actor Greg Morris of Mission Impossible. And Friday, Bob Teague of NBC News. All this next week on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to Robert Choate about Hunger USA. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And welcome to the Night Call stations who join us nightly for the second half hour each evening. Tonight our conversation is Hunger USA. 10 million Americans are starving right now, and our guest calling in from Washington, D.C. is Mr. Robert Choate of the National Institute of Public Affairs. And just before we return to our guest, a special note for our Night Call Network stations. We will feed the correct promo spots for Wednesday's use on closed circuit following tonight's program. So following our program tonight, we will feed the correct promo spots for Wednesday's use and hope that you'll be with us. Mr. Choate, we were just prior to station identification, we were attempting to find out if the diet that is available for many families who do have the food stamps, whether or not this particular diet is I don't want to say substantial, but is it adequate? I'm wondering if when we talk about starvation in America, do we say, well, as long as people have something to eat, that is all that is necessary?
Well, I think the best way to approach this is to describe the three major feeding programs that we have now just very briefly and show how badly they cover the problems of the poor. We had just finished saying that there are 27 million poor and roughly 6 million people are fed or helped in their food problems by the family food programs. Now, for instance, there are 3.2 million people who get help from the commodity direct distribution program. That means that they go once a month to a warehouse and get enough food based on the size of their family to last them about 2.5 weeks to 3 weeks of the month. In other words, they have to really stretch that food to make it last a month, and they may end up hungry at the end of the month.
Now, is
they are beneficiaries of the commodity program.
Now, is this food free?
This food is free.
Right, okay.
And that's operative in about 1,250 of the nation's 3,100 counties. Now, the other main food program for the poor family is the food stamp program, and that has about 2.6 million people participating in 1,166 counties out of the 3,100 counties in the United States. Now, in the food stamp program, for some ridiculous reason, you have to buy your way into a federal program. The food stamp program may well recognize that the average middle-class American only spends about 17% of his income for food, but the food stamp program demands of the poverty family that they spend 37 to 50% of their monthly income for food and spend it before they know what the income for that month is going to be. After having spent 37 to 50% of their monthly budget for food, they then only have enough food to last them for two-thirds of the month. So I think that the food stamp program, which is being loudly touted by some of the congressional leaders and some of the administration leaders that are currently in control today, I think it's a fraud. I think it is a program that needs drastic revision before it can be advocated for every county of the United States in place of the direct distribution commodity program. Let me just throw in one more item here. The other program that we hear most about in the United States is the school lunch program. Not many people realize there are 50 million children of school age. Not many people realize that 18 million people, only 18 million children, participate in the school lunch program, so that there's a huge gap there. Not many people realize that of that 18 million who do get school lunches, only 2 million are poor who get free or drastically reduced in price lunches. The rest, 16 million students, are middle-class students who well could afford the full price of their meal, but because of regulations and congressional intent, it is now much easier to feed middle-class Americans a lunch at 4 to 11 cent discount rather than getting free meals to the poor who desperately need it for their only square meal of the day. So that participation in the federal food program doesn't guarantee you freedom from hunger, but it probably will guarantee you freedom from starvation. At the same time, there are large numbers of Americans who can't get into any of these programs, and they are in dire trouble.
All right, this time, sir, we'll go out to Loveland, Colorado. Mr. Gothwaite is hearing Night Call over KLOV-FM. Mr. Gothwaite?
Yes, good evening, Del.
Good evening, sir.
I have three questions, real short. I had two, but you've just raised another one I'd like to ask about. First of all, I'll articulate these separately and then ask for a response so we won't get mixed up. First of all, to what extent does politics enter into the picture in the release, or you might say the allocation of foods in these various aid programs, in the present programs that are administered by the Department of Agriculture?
My first reply is that these programs are loaded with politics. They're loaded with farm and agricultural establishment politics. There are the agricultural committees of the House and the Senate and the agricultural appropriation subcommittees in the House and the Senate, which are led by individuals who have a long record of proving their disinterest in the poor. These individuals are regularly reviewing the federal food programs and seem totally disinclined to get them out to the really hungry people of America who really need food help. There is plenty of politics in the administration of food programs. The White House for the last 2 years has refused to recognize that hunger is in America. The White House has prevented the Bureau of the Budget from making a proper assessment of the costs of programs were they to really get out to the poor. And perhaps worst of all, in the recently instituted nationwide study of hunger and malnutrition in the United States, which was really launched because of the stories of hunger and starvation in Mississippi, the one state that was quickly crossed off of that list of states for study for hunger and malnutrition was Mississippi. And that was done at the request of Congressman James Whitten of Mississippi, who didn't want any more facts brought out about hunger and malnutrition in Mississippi.
Do you feel that integration of industry into this program, this aid program, which, as I understand it, correct me here if I'm wrong, is what you're advocating, at least to some extent, do you feel that integration of industry into this program would alleviate this problem to some extent, or would it compound it, this problem of politics?
I suspect that the profit motive is even stronger than the political reward motive. And in certain states of the Southeast where Negroes are being prevented from gaining access to federal food programs, I think a contract written with private industry, which is based on an incentive system to reward private industry if it gets food out to those who really need it, I think that can overcome local politics.
Right. But let me move on to this second question, which concerns itself partly with the first. What are the economic ramifications, speaking in domestic terms here, of mass release, or let's say more extensive release of these surplus, so-called surplus, that's a damnable term, these so-called surplus commodities? What are the economic ramifications of the release of these commodities into these underprivileged areas?
I think the quickest answer to that is, in the main, those surpluses, which we all think of lying in silos and in bins on the ground, those are really not with us anymore. We do have an overabundance of food in the United States, but not too much of it is rotting away in silos. And I don't think the sudden flooding of what is in our silos onto the market would do much for the poor. Actually, the payoff programs, which have bribed farmers not to produce more food so that market prices stay stable, have in effect worked to reduce the embarrassing gluts that we had, say, 2 decades ago. Today, we have more than enough food in the United States, but we don't have embarrassing surpluses sitting around.
Well, I want you view this then as a move, a program by the government kind of working against itself. On the one hand, restricting the farmers' output in certain what they call critical areas, and then on the other hand, trying to well, I see it as a token effort to trying to aid the persons that don't have enough to eat.
I think you're right, Mr. Goldthwait. What really has happened is that there are six major federal programs which supposedly concern themselves with the food plight of the poor. Some people think there are seven. But of these six programs, four of them state right in the legislative history that they were primarily developed to take care of the farmer and his possible market surpluses. They were only secondarily developed to feed poor people. As a result, the administrators, who aren't noted for their backbone, usually kowtow to the agricultural establishment and the agricultural congressmen and senators, and do not pay attention to the hungry poor, who they recognize as being the non-voting poor.
Right, let me go very quickly. I realize Dell, I want to move on. This third item was concerning the school lunch program, the inequities that are obviously built into this program, which you articulated a few minutes ago. But let me ask this. In watching this program operate, one sees that there are certain, what I believe to be asinine procedures that are demanded by the federal government. One of these is this full portion ruling, where if a child gets his lunch in his school, he has to be given, even if he says to the individual dispensing this product, you know, the waitress, so to speak, that he's not going to eat that salad or he's not going to eat those green beans, that he has to be served those green beans. And such a large quantity of this food, basically the green vegetables and traditionally unpopular foods with a younger set, seem to go down the drain. In fact, they do go down the drain in appalling amounts.
Well, my response to that has to be somewhat from ignorance. I recognize that there are set servings which have to be issued. At the same time, we recognize that the body must consume a certain volume of nutrients during the course of a week to stay in proper health. Now, either that child is going to gain those nutrients, including vitamin A and vitamin C, from the citrus or the vegetable sources, or that child is going to have to get it from, shall we say, artificial sources otherwise supplied. If you want to reduce the size of the portion, there are certain areas of the United States which will so reduce the size of that portion so that the child, in effect, is not getting enough to eat.
Well, my problem, I think, that I'm speaking of is a problem of, at the local level, of having to put a certain quantity of each item on this plate, even if the individual says he's not going to eat it and by experience does not eat it. You speak about having to have the vitamins, but if he doesn't eat the item, he certainly isn't going to take in the vitamins. Now, instead of having to, by some kind of federal decree, at least this is the way I understood it, a federal decree that if they're going to serve the kid a lunch at all, they have to serve him a lunch with absolutely everything on it, so that it's on that particular lunch menu.
Well, I must say that you raise my suspicions as you describe this condition right now. It sounds like one more instance of where the regulation setters have been advocating certain practices which will increase the consumption of food, maybe by the garbage can instead of the human being, but it sounds like they want to have the volume of food upped, thereby to help the farm market. A consumer-oriented program certainly will provide a vitamin A and vitamin C item in a school lunch every day, but if the local school notes that the preponderance of pupils aren't consuming that item, then certainly they can find some other means, perhaps with a fortified food product, of supplying that same vitamin A and vitamin C and getting it into the stomachs that need it.
Right.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Instead of forcing the child, you're not forcing him, you're just making available to him these foods that he's not going to eat, green salads and vegetables. Why not put that artificial, as you call it, vitamin capsule in his apple pie that you know he's going to eat?
Well, I think that we have to recognize this. Dell, I think we've got an interesting point here. There are a great many cultural diets around the United States which, in effect, may not be as well-rounded as one would hope. In other words, there are some who have been eating grits and fat back now for a number of years or a number of generations. It's become a way of life that certainly one would like to have a variation from, but it still is a sort of a basic pattern to the diet. In the Southwest, where I've spent many years, tortillas and tamales are well known in the diets of some of our friends from Mexico and our Mexican-American citizens. These will stay in the diets, and if those same diets don't include enough vitamin A and vitamin C, then I would say that we have to add those items to some other ingredient in those present diets so that the individuals eating that diet will start to get a fully rounded meal.
Mr. Garthwaite, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Schultz, in reference to the food stamp program, where you stated earlier that 2.6 million people are currently involved in this particular program, is there any truth at all, or is there, I'm going to ask for truth, is there any truth at all to the possibility that when food stamps are issued, that the stores in the communities where the stamps are traded in for food, do the prices go up as it has happened in the ghetto areas prior to just a few days before the welfare checks are sent out? There has been evidence that stores raise prices. Does this also happen with the food stamps?
Yeah, I'm sure it does. I don't think it happens everywhere, and I wouldn't like to issue a blanket indictment, but I'm certain that there are some grocers who are so eager for those last few pennies of change that they do raise the prices on the day when food stamps are made available. On the other hand, there are some controls that the government could be exerting on those same stores that it is not exerting. For instance, there has been practically no policing of the stores that honor food stamps. One must realize that a store, when honoring food stamps, in effect is guaranteed a market and is guaranteed a customer. In the South particularly, we find that some of these grocery stores are operating on credit practices that are specifically prohibited in the regulations and the law, and yet these same stores are operating on credit practices which prevent the stamp owner from going to any other store and keep him continually in doubt as to how much he owes the store. We feel very strongly, those of us who have looked at these programs over the last 18 months, about the apparent pattern of eviction from certain rural areas of the South, which seem to be part and parcel of the peculiar operation of the food programs. Another way to say this is that the availability of food in the South, in the Southeast and the Southwest, seems to be peculiarly short in those areas where large numbers of minority citizens are just learning how to vote, just learning how to send their children to desegregated schools. We see the shortage of food being used as an eviction tool to get such individuals out of the local economy and out to other areas of the country which are also not prepared to handle large problems of low-income citizens.
Mr. Schultz, we'll come back to you right after station identification. This is the Night Call Network in New York. We'll return after station identification.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest hunger expert Robert Schultz after station identification. Tomorrow night on Night Call, what have bumper stickers in the far west to do with firebombs in New York City, or the Archbishop of San Antonio with a union trying to organize migrant farm workers in California, or a Mexican-American union leader who quotes Gandhi with a nationwide boycott of table drapes? These are all facets of the Cesar Chavez story, the man who fasted for 25 days to gain the support of Senator Robert Kennedy, turned down a $250,000 federal grant so he could retain his independence, and says no union movement is worth the life of one farm worker or his child, one grower or his child. The Migrant Workers with Cesar Chavez, head of the AFL-CIO's United Farm Workers Organizing Committee, tomorrow night on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in North America to Robert Schultz about Hunger USA. Call Night Call Collect from the East End Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And as we return to our guest, Mr. Robert Schott of the National Institute of Public Affairs, continuing our conversation on Hunger USA, 10 million Americans are starving right now. We'll take a local call. Mr. Durante is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM here in New York. Mr. Durante?
Yes.
How are you, sir?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, well, I had a question here, and then I'll hang up and let the gentleman answer, because I'm on my way to work and I'll be listening.
All right.
That was not too long ago. I think it was in Australia or some foreign country. Wanted to send some food over to the States here for people who were starving, and it was refused by someone in the State Department. Could the gentleman comment on that, please?
I haven't heard that story, but it doesn't surprise me. I think it would be really quite an eye-opener to the American public if suddenly a shipload of food came into New York Harbor or into some southern harbor to feed hungry people. I have not heard of an Australian shipment, but I am certain that the current administration would have uttered an absolute prohibition against any such activity, lest they be embarrassed by their non-performance in the food line.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Up to Boston this time, Mr. Gennady is hearing Night Call over WBUR-FM. Mr. Gennady?
Good afternoon. Good evening. I'd like to ask Mr. Schott a question. In view of the comments that you've made on the distributional efficiency of private enterprise in the area of food, I wonder if you could comment on the following. It's my thoughts that by supporting farm prices, the poor of America are the first to suffer, and would in fact be the first to benefit from reduced prices brought about by farmers competing in an open market, which would necessitate their using efficient farming techniques and which would consequently be reflected in lower farm prices.
I think I can answer that quickly. If, in my humble opinion, if you take all controls off of farm production, you're going to find that very quickly huge cycles get set up where farmers plant a massive wheat one year and a massive barley the next year, and then maybe back to wheat the third year. You're going to find that wheat prices drop out of sight so that a large number of these farmers go broke in the first and third years, and in the second year the price of wheat will be sky high because not enough people planted it. I think the irregularity that would come in such cycles would offset any benefits that might accrue to the poor by the elimination of the sort of planting control programs. I do think that the government can do a much better job than it's doing now, and don't misunderstand me on that. But I do think that there's got to be some sort of a control on agricultural production, lest we suddenly find ourselves with feast or famine, depending upon who made how much money the previous year as prices soared or as prices dropped.
Thank you, Mr. Chutt.
Thank you for calling, Sam. This time out to Pueblo, Colorado. Mrs. Sanford is hearing Night Call over KCSJ. Mrs. Sanford?
Yes, sir.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Your question, ma'am.
Returning to the food stamps, why are they not allowed to purchase soap, toilet paper, and things that are a dire necessity?
Good for you. Good for you. I think, A, they have to be. I think the food stamp program has got to be totally altered. I think it ought to be called a living standard stamp, and I think it ought to allow the holder to exert some preference for whether they buy domestic food, whether they buy basic clothing, such as shoes, whether they buy personal hygiene necessities, such as soaps and detergents, or whether they buy something that will improve the sanitation in and around the home. I think the food stamp idea has some merit, except that the present program is more set up to benefit grocers than it is the poor. At the same time, I think that the food stamp program can be greatly expanded to include the basic necessities of life, which will provide the recipients then with sort of a basic standard of American living beneath which none of us want to see them existing.
You're right. And another thing, they are permitted to have pop and things like that that are not necessities and are detrimental.
Well, at the same time, one cannot dictate to the poor that they shall have so many beans, so much tomatoes, so much apples, etc. They're going to be just as choosy as you and I are, and they ought to have the right to make some selections. What I'd rather see is have the soda pop fortified so that, like Vitasoy in Hong Kong and Pro Nutro in South Africa and Sassi in Brazil, that these soft drinks, which are extremely popular with a malnourished public, have enough nutrient content so that one gains from drinking them instead of losing.
Right.
Thank you for calling, Mr. Sanford.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Del?
Yes, sir.
I hope that your listeners are by now sufficiently interested in the subject of hunger and malnutrition in this country, so they'll take a look at some of the recent articles that have come out in national publications on this subject. The Reader's Digest of this November 1968 has a major article on hunger. Good Housekeeping of October 1968 has such an article. Esquire of June of 68 had a major article on a terrible state of affairs in South Carolina. And, of course, Look magazine back last December carried a classic article on hungry Americans. This is where to turn for the facts that we don't have time to give out over the air. And at the same time, if one really becomes upset reading these conditions, I hope that they will write Richard Nixon, White House, and tell him to get cracking on food reform.
Well, in the area of hunger, Mr. Choate, the apathy that is generally registered by American people, is it due to the fact that most people assume that all of the hungry people are black people?
I would guess that somewhat less than 50% of the American hungry public was of a minority group. Sure, we jump to the conclusion that they must be black or brown or illiterate or aged or on reservations or something like that. But most of us forget that the majority of those 27 million impoverished Americans are white Anglo-Saxons. They too are suffering, and even were somebody to be black or brown or living on an Indian reservation, their human condition is just as much of concern to this country as any other person, and we ought to pay attention to it. And I think, thanks to the press and thanks to some astute citizens who have taken an early interest in this cause, I don't think it is too many months away before we start to get some real legislative and administrative reform in these programs.
Mr. Choate, thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call.
My pleasure.
Tonight, our conversation, Hunger USA, our guest, Mr. Robert Choate of the National Institute of Public Affairs, calling in from Washington, D.C. This is Del Shoes in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, the migrant farm worker and the table grape boycott with union organizer Cesar Chavez. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalitions.